Thank you. I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation to speak here, and to thank all of you for coming to a talk advertised by a giant metallic monster. Could everybody please stand up for me? We are going to learn a dance move. Don't worry, it's simple. I call it the photoisomer. The photoisomer is a molecular switch. It has two chemical groups represented by these circles here. So pick up your hands. Your hands are going to serve as the chemical groups. Now put your hands up. You are in the cis configuration. So if anyone looks down your profile, as far as they can see, 0 degrees separate your chemical groups. Now, light is shining on us, and when light shines on a photoisomer, it has the opportunity to be a molecular switch and switch. So, without hitting anyone next to you, rotate one arm downward. You are now in the trans configuration. If anyone looks down your profile, they will see 180 degrees separating your chemical groups. Now, put your hands up again. So put your hands up in the air, wave them around like you just don't care. That wasn't necessary for the photoisomer, I just wanted to see you do that. And do the photoisomer. Well done, give yourselves a round of applause. Thank you. So, why did I subject you to this torture? Because photoisomers are common and useful across nature and technologies. For example, we have photoisomers in our eyes. Retinol is a molecule on rhodopsin, a protein that helps us see. In another example, there was an experimental team at Harvard and MIT that took these graphene nanotubules and stuck photoisomers on them. The photoisomers enhanced solar fuel storage for a reason I'll explain. But since photoisomers are so common and so useful, we're motivated to ask, how effectively can these molecular switches switch? Alas, photoisomers are small, quantum, and far from equilibrium, so they're difficult to model. We might be inclined to make assumptions in order to gain traction, but those assumptions can well be violated. We seek simple, general, thermodynamic-style bounds on the probability that a photoisomer photoisomerizes. This is called the photoisomerization yield. Fortunately, quantum information theory comes to our rescue. There's a mathematical toolkit within quantum information theory called the resource theory framework. Resource theories are simple information theoretic models. They've been used over the past few years to extend laws of thermodynamics to small systems, to quantum states, and to far from equilibrium states. This framework has minimal assumptions. Basically, energy conservation, the presence of an environmental bath at a fixed temperature, and quantum mechanics. But papers about resource theories are very abstract and information theoretic. So they have the style lemma, lemma, theorem, theorem, lemma, theorem, corollary. Still, we could have an idea. Suppose that we could take this real physical system and model it within this very abstract framework. We might be able to find the right theorem out there to evaluate on our system of interest so we could bound the photoisomerization probability. Those are the tests that I undertook with David Limmer, who's a chemist at UC Berkeley. And that's what I'm going to talk about during this talk. First, I'll give more background about photoisomers. Then I'll introduce thermodynamic resource theories. I want to advertise these as a toolkit for modeling open quantum systems. Then I'll present our results. I'll show how to model this molecule within a resource theory. Then I'll bound the photoisomerization yield. I'll argue that electronic coherences relative to the energy eigenbases don't help the switching. And then I'll ask, what similar systems might you have that might benefit from a resource theory treatment? Let's start by learning more about photoisomers. You can model the energy landscape like this. Along the x-axis, I have the rotational coordinate phi that gives the angle between the two chemical groups. Remember, there are these two important points, the cis configuration at 0 degrees and the trans configuration at 180 degrees. This degree of freedom belongs to nuclei, so it is heavy and slow. This heavy degree of freedom defines the the energies accessible to the lighter degree of freedom, which is the electronic degree of freedom. So if you fix an angle between the nuclei, you're taking a slice on this diagram and you're fixing the energy levels accessible to the electronic degree of freedom. The electronic degree of freedom is effectively like a qubit. Here's what happens during the photoisomerization process. The molecule starts out in equilibrium at room temperature. That state is well approximated with the ground state here. Then we shine light, maybe a laser, on the molecule. In the best possible case, the molecule is photoexcited all the way to the top state. Then the molecule has the opportunity to rotate, and as it rotates, it has the opportunity to slide down this energy curve. In the best possible case, it'll get down here. In order to get downward, it has to dissipate energy, so this system really is an open quantum system. In the best possible case, it'll get to this level. This is a metastable state because it's a little bit above the ground state. So suppose that this were used in to harvest solar energy. Then we would have energy from the sun photoexciting the molecule, and that photon would be stored in this metastable state for a time like the lifetime of the state. Now let's get into resource theories. Resource theories form a toolkit within quantum information theory. A resource theory is an information theoretic model for any situation in which there are constraints on the systems you can access easily and the operations you can perform easily. Those easily accessible systems we call free systems. For example, consider thermodynamics at a fixed temperature. The systems you can access easily are those at thermal equilibrium relative to that temperature. The easily performable operations we call free operations. For instance, in thermodynamics, we are restricted to obey the first law of energy conservation. Everything that's not free, we call a resource. We might be able to use it in an information processing or thermodynamic task. For instance, suppose that we have some hot bath as our environment and we're suddenly given a cold bath. We can let heat flow from one to the other. From the heat flow, we can extract work. Work is valuable, so it makes sense to think of this cold system that's not at thermal equilibrium relative to the environment as a resource. I'm sure that by the end of this talk, you'll be so excited about resource theories, you will have to model your favorite thermodynamic system within a resource theory. How are you going to do that? We model a system by specifying a Hilbert space, curly H, and a density operator rho and a Hamiltonian defined on that Hilbert space. We often speak in terms of some thermodynamic agent given access to a bath at an inverse temperature beta. The free states are the ones that are at thermal equilibrium relative to that inverse temperature. So the agent can dream up his or her favorite Hamiltonian H sub B, reach into the bath, and draw out a piece of it. The free operations are called thermal operations. Shockingly, they tend to bring systems down toward thermal equilibrium. Each thermal operation consists of three steps. One can take a piece of the bath and bring it over to the system, couple the two together with a global unitary that conserves the total energy, and discard a subsystem that's not coupled to the rest of the system. But mathematically, a thermal operation looks like this. You start off with a system rho H. A piece of the bath comes over and contacts the system. The two evolve under a global unitary that conserves the total Hamiltonian, Hamiltonian of system, plus Hamiltonian of bath. This is a manifestation of the first law of thermodynamics. Finally, a subsystem that here I'm calling A can be discarded. So the system state evolves like this. The Hamiltonian transforms like that. Let's model the photoisomer within the resource theory. The Hilbert space of the molecule is a tensor product of the electronic space and the nuclear space. The Hamiltonian I'll write like this. There is a rotational kinetic energy term for the chemical groups that is active at all angles between the chemical groups. So I'll integrate over all angles phi from 0 to pi. If you specify an angle between the chemical groups, you specify the effective Hamiltonian experienced by the electronic degree of freedom, you've taken a slice out of this diagram. Now let's model photoisomerization with thermal operations. We start off with the molecule in its thermal state. It's in the cis configuration, closed up. And the state is well approximated with this ground state. We also have around some state of light source, like a laser, maybe it's a coherent state. During the first thermal operation, photoexcitation happens. Energy moves from the light source into the molecule. So the electronic state might have some coherences spread across the cis levels. During the next thermal operation, rotation happens. The molecule ends up with some electronic state. Sigma electronic might have some coherences spread across these trans levels. We want to know what is the greatest probability that, at the end of the day, the system will end up with its weight down on the metastable level. To answer that question, we'll invoke one of those abstract theorems from the resource theory framework. These are called second laws of thermodynamics. How do we use the second law in conventional thermodynamics? We think about some macrostates, maybe in which a bunch of classical ideal gas particles are clumped up in one corner of a box. And we have in mind a second macrostate, for instance, that in which the particles are spread across the box. And we ask, can one macrostate turn into the other spontaneously? To answer this question, we identify the relevant free energy. If the gas can exchange heat with some temperature T bath through the walls of the box, the relevant free energy is the Helmholtz free energy. The transformation can happen spontaneously if and only if that free energy declines monotonically. When we tell this story, we have in mind some assumptions implicitly. The states are equilibrium states, the system is thermodynamically large, some averages stand behind what we're saying. We want to step away from those assumptions. But let's rephrase the question in the resource theory framework. We'll have in mind an initial system, rho h, and a final system, sigma h prime. We'll ask, does there exist any free operation that maps one to the other? This is a more general question, so we need to do some more mathematical legwork. We can't just check one inequality, we have to check a whole family of inequalities. These are called second laws. There are two subfamilies of second laws. One subfamily governs the diagonals of the density matrices. So here's the question that we asked. Each of these states can be represented by a matrix relative to the Hamiltonian's eigenbasis. The elements along the diagonal are the probabilities that if you measure the energy, the outcome will be blank. Those diagonal elements evolve under one set of second laws. The off-diagonal elements are the coherences. They evolve in accordance with another subfamily of second laws. We are interested in one of the diagonal elements. Let's start applying the second laws to our photoisomer. This is the abstract question that we asked. Let's make it concrete for our molecule. The initial state is the photoexcited state, which we've already written out, and the final state is this post-rotation state. The two Hamiltonians equal each other. They equal just the molecular Hamiltonian that I showed earlier. We can think of this molecular Hamiltonian as an effective four-level system because we're just interested in the initial state and the final state. So we're interested in two nuclear states, cis and trans. Each nuclear state defines two electronic states, and 2 × 2 = 4. Let's start using the second laws now. Let's start with the coherences. There's a result that says you can take this density operator and divide it up into modes of coherence. Now, each element of the density operator is in a row corresponding to one energy and a column corresponding to another energy. You take the difference between those two energies, that difference defines the mode. So look at the diagonal. There, the column energy is the same as the row energy, so the gap is zero. This is the zeroth mode. You step just off the diagonal, you get to the next mode. Step just off, you get to the next mode, and so on. Our result says that under thermal operations, these modes of coherence transform independently. Now, we're interested in one of the diagonal elements. So according to this result, the off-diagonal elements don't affect that diagonal element. So in our calculations, we might as well just set the off-diagonal elements to zero to simplify. In other words, we were thinking about this electronic state that might have some coherences, but we can just decohere, we can just take the probability weights and focus on those. I'll call those R minus and R plus. The same thing is true of the final electronic state, psi electronic. sigma electronic, we can focus on the weights S minus and S plus. Now let's get to the subfamily of second laws for the energy diagonal. How do we apply these in general, or how do they look in general? I'm going to use implicitly a mathematical toolkit called majorization. I'm not going to get into details. I'll just show you some results, abstract results. So how do we check whether the diagonal of this state can turn into the diagonal of that state under some free thermalizing type operation? We do the following. We take the probabilities, the diagonal elements, from this state rho, and we rescale each one with an inverse Boltzmann factor. This probability encodes an informational resource. It tells us how well we can predict the outcome of an energy measurement. We know from Maxwell's Demon that information is valuable in thermodynamics. Maxwell's Demon uses information to decrease entropy. This inverse Boltzmann factor encodes the energetic resource, which is obviously a resource in thermodynamics. So we're constructing a mathematical object that encodes both informational and energetic resources, which are valuable in thermodynamic processes. Then we reorder the rescaled probabilities from greatest to least. And we form partial sums that we plot like this. Here along the x-axis, you'll see a bunch of tick marks. The first is at the origin. The next tick mark is at the first Boltzmann factor. To get to the next tick mark, you add the next Boltzmann factor, and so on until you've added all the Boltzmann factors and gotten to the partition function. Each of these tick marks corresponds to one point. Here's how we form the y-coordinates. The first point is at the origin. The next y-coordinate is at the first probability diagonal element. To get to the next y-coordinate, we add the next probability, and so on until we've added all of the probabilities and gotten one. So now we've formed a bunch of points. We connect the points with straight lines, and the result is called a Gibbs rescaled Lorentz curve, which is a very fancy way of saying a geometric object that encodes the total thermodynamic value of our system, informational and energetic. This encodes the information about one state. We want to compare two states, ask whether one can flow into the other via some free operation. So we plot the two curves on the same plots. We use the following theorem. It says there exists a free operation that maps the rho to the sigma if and only if the rho curve lies everywhere above or on the sigma curve. That is true in this diagram. So here, rho can turn into sigma via free operation. That basically means that rho has more thermodynamic value, you can extract more work from it, you need more work to prepare it, and so on. Note that I say everywhere, at all x-coordinates. So when you check whether this theorem applies to a system, you are checking a whole bunch of inequalities, a whole bunch of second laws. But let's take that abstract result and apply it to our photoisomer. We're going to do the following. We know that the laser is going to excite the isomer to some states. We can write down the form of that state. And then we take the diagonal elements, R minus and R plus. Then we use normalization of a state to write S plus up here as 1 minus S minus. We plug into the second laws and we have one free parameter, which is S minus. We solve for the greatest S minus, for which the rho curve is everywhere above or on the S curve, which means that this initial state will be able to turn via this thermalizing operation into the final state. For the sake of the plots I'll show, I'll point out that there is this gap between the ground state and the metastable state that I'm now calling delta E. Delta E is small, namely in comparison to the gap between the two cis states. On each plot, on the x-axis, I'm going to show you this gap here. And on the y-axis, I'm going to show you bounds on the probability of photoisomerization. I'm going to show you plots for three regimes. In the first regime, the laser is very good. It always photoexcites the isomer all the way to this top level. This blue curve shows the upper bound from the resource theory, which here is trivial. It's one. There's an upper bound of one that the probability that the photoisomer will photoisomerize, which looks a little bit silly, but we can understand it by breaking down the state in terms of thermodynamic resources. So this state is the highest energy eigenstates, the most energy. So this has a ton of energy. It would make sense to think that it can flow downward into any other state. Furthermore, this is an energy eigenstate, a pure state. If you measure the energy, you know exactly which outcome will obtain. So this has a lot of informational resource. It has a ton of energy resourcefulness, a ton of informational value. Of course, there's no fundamental thermodynamic limitation on how well this molecule can get into another state. Now, there is a red dashed line here. That is a lower bound on the photoisomerization yield. It comes from just equilibrium considerations of detailed balance. So we have an upper bound, we have a lower bound, and we're constraining the photoisomerization probability. Now, suppose that the laser is just so-so. So it excites half the state up to the upper level. Since relative to, in this case, some of the probability weight has dropped down to a lower energy level, this state has less energy, so of course it has less thermodynamic value, but also it has less informational value because the weights are spread across two levels. Though if we measure the energy, we're not sure which outcome we'll obtain. This has less energetic resourcefulness, less informational resourcefulness, so the bound on the probability is lower. We're constraining the bound more tightly. Now suppose that the laser is really poor. It barely excites the photoisomer at all. Then you might think the photoisomer has no hope of getting into the photoisomerized state. But according to the resource theory results, fundamental thermodynamic limitations don't provide so much limitation if this gap is small. Why? Because of informational resource. This is a pure energy eigenstate. If you measure the energy, you know exactly which outcome we'll obtain. So that informational resource helps make up, to some extent, for the lack of energy in this state, if the gap is small. As the gap widens, your hope of photoisomerizing decreases, as we expect. We have used fundamental limitations of thermodynamics, just basic thermodynamic assumptions, to make quantitative the bounds on the photoisomerization probability. We found that if the laser is quite poor, which is the case in a number of realistic applications, then the constraint is relatively tight. We can also understand the bounds by thinking in terms of energy and information resources. Furthermore, we constructed a simple Lindblad hopping model in order to test out our bound, and we found a realistic parameter regime in which we could saturate the bound in each of the three cases. We also concluded that electronic coherences relative to the energy eigenbasis can't help the switching probability. Now, there are other things that you can do, other theorems that you can pluck out of the resource theory literature and apply to this photoisomer. For instance, the minimal work required to excite the photoisomer. We start with a photoisomer down in this level. And suppose that we shine a laser on it, and we photoexcite it to some partially or fully photoexcited state. You might think, oh, the energy needed is just the gap. Well, that's a very good guess for the average energy, but we like often thinking about, say, the single photon limit, so it makes sense to ask about the absolute minimum energy required to photoexcite the molecule. So we quantified that minimum work required using an entropic quantity from quantum information theory. And you can also, in principle, extract work from coherences if you have two isomers together interacting. In summary, we learned the hottest dance craze sweeping the nation, at least the chemistry and material science and physics community. The photoisomer, a small molecular switch that is prevalent in nature and in technologies, but is small, quantum, and far from equilibrium, so it's difficult to model. In order to model it with minimal assumptions, we invoked the resource theory framework. We learned about thermodynamic resource theories. We saw how all of you will model your favorite systems within a thermodynamic resource theory. We reviewed some results, the second laws of thermodynamics. We also saw the results from our paper. We saw how to model a physical system, this molecular switch, within the resource theory. And we bounded the photoisomerization probability using these results, these second laws. For open questions, I'd like to pose the following. First, again, I'd like to advertise thermodynamic resource theories for modeling open quantum systems. I'm curious about what systems you might be using or be familiar with that could, like the photoisomer, benefit from a resource theory treatment. My collaborator and I were thinking about films of quantum dots in which there's exciton transports, or photovoltaics, or other molecular systems like chlorophyll. Some questions that we can ask to try to identify systems that might benefit from resource theory modeling would be, when do you need fundamental limitations? When are you thinking about both energy and information transport or processing? Especially in the context of small scales, coherent quantum states, single shots rather than averages, and baths that aren't infinitely large. Thanks for your time.
Thanks. Thank you, Nicole. We have lots of time for questions.
So I was wondering, in this example where you were measuring the efficiency to photoisomerize with a laser, a bad laser, a good laser, have you also thought about using or considering an incoherent type of excitation, like with a bath or, you know, with a thermal bath, like it happens, for instance, in photovoltaics and also, I guess, in nature with, when you have such molecules?
Yes, we were thinking of letting the light source be quite general and just, once you fix the light source and you fix the interaction, then you can get the form of the photoexcited states, which might be fully photoexcited or not at all. And you basically input that photoexcited states into the second laws. So you can input any photoexcited state that you please. In the regimes that I showed, there were a spread of weights. And the reason that we weren't thinking about the coherence is we were asking the specific question about the probability of photoisomerizing, and we concluded via resource theory results that coherences of the electronic state relative to the energy eigenbasis can't help with that task. But you could certainly pose different questions for which coherences might be relevant.
So my question is sort of similar to that and following on from that. So just to clarify, this thermodynamic resource theories can also be useful in situations where you have coherences?
Yes.
And do you have a question in mind that, or a process in mind that you might be using this for? Or are you looking for one?
Sure. Well, partially I'm always looking for some, and I'm open to suggestions. One question that my collaborator and I have discussed is in the context of exciton transport in quantum dot films. There are a lot of expectations, and there's evidence that, okay, so what is the setup? We have a bunch of quantum dots, a bunch of artificial atoms, and we have a light source. There's going to be some excitation. Then there's going to be a splitting of that into charges that will either hop around and get eventually to the end of the film, at which point the energy can be collected, which can be a good thing. Or, so this hopping is somewhat incoherent. But on the other hand, there could be coherences in the initial states, so the initial state could be spread out across a bunch of quantum dots. And there are expectations and there is evidence that this greater coherence in spreading across space can assist with the transport to the edges of the film where the energy is collected. We thought that it could be an interesting opportunity to take this angle to make quantitative those expectations that that coherence would help with that energy transport.
Hey, so I really enjoyed the talk. I got a couple very related questions. So the first is, how does this analysis scale as the system gets quite large? And second is, could you apply this analysis to a problem that's much closer to quantum computer science, like thermalization between spin glass states?
Yeah, there actually has been some work that connects resource theories, in particular thermodynamic resource theories, to a feature of quantum computing, namely algorithmic cooling. So for people who aren't so familiar with this problem, suppose that we want to do quantum computing for a long time. We need a lot of fresh ancillas that are reset to the zero state. It's like getting a lot of fresh scratch paper that we need to do a lot of computations. There is an algorithm to cool systems to their ground states called algorithmic cooling, and that has been analyzed within the resource theory framework. There are a couple of papers about that. So there's at least one connection. Then as to how this scales to large systems, I have to say a lot of the analysis that has been done with resource theories, well, first of all, there haven't been a whole lot of applications, period. Pretty much everything has been small scale so far. And that's one of the reasons why I think that this framework really needs to be brought out outside of itself into this broader community so that we can see what those opportunities are like. One reason to have hope, let's say, for larger quantum systems is that a lot of this framework is quite simple. Again, there are minimal assumptions.
So in principle, one could use two lasers, right? In a lambda configuration.
In a what configuration?
Lambda configuration, such that you would transfer the population between cis and trans without populating the excited electronic state, like in a CPT kind of scheme. So is it unfeasible for some reason, or in principle one could try that?
Are you saying that in my diagram, the level structure is there, that you would just use the level structure that is there?
Yeah, but you would use two lasers, one coupling cis to the electronically excited state, and another one coupling electronically excited state to trans, right? And you know, if you have coherent population trapping, that then you can just transfer it directly and coherently. In principle, I mean, probably you've thought about it, and it's impossible for some reason. So I wonder why.
I'm not familiar with any work that's been done on that. So there are a few ways to think about this. One is that that might be an opportunity. One is we can think about these photoisomers in their natural settings. So for instance, in our eyes, then the photoisomers are pretty well modeled as more or less on their own in some bath. So it would be the bath that is taking up the energy instead of the second laser. So that's one reason, or that was part of the motivation for our model. And yeah, basically in a lot of the applications that I know of, there is this bath around, and there tends to be, especially during the avoided crossing, there can be a somewhat strong coupling to the bath. So that might interfere with the coherent transformation that you are suggesting. But in principle, when we're thinking about a lab setting, I don't off the top of my head know of any barriers to that suggestion.
Thank you.
So you talked about minimal assumptions. I didn't quite understand whether it was essential to know where the system ends and the environment begins in applying this framework. I ask particularly because in, say, exciton transport problems in light harvesting complexes, both theoretically and experimentally, it's not possible to tell where sort of the system ends or where the excitonic system ends and the vibrational modes begin. Can you comment on that?
Okay. In this system, it's, at least from the way that I see it, there's more of a clear separation in that we regard the molecule as the system of interest, and what it interacts with, everything else forms the bath. Then suppose that we get into another problem in which the separation is not as clear, then yeah, I would advocate for doing some thinking about where we would want to draw the line. In the resource theory, the bath plays the role of providing these Gibbs states that are supplied during these thermal operations. So that's the role that the bath plays there. We would want to model the bath. We would want to be able to model the bath with the Gibbs states, although very recently there was a paper that I saw about extending to an imperfect bath. So I think there are some there are some possibilities to play with the constraints.
if I understand you correctly, these bounds don't tell you anything about time scales, right? I mean, it just tells you there might be transition, it might take forever. And on the other hand, I think it's actually not so difficult to model the problem, no? I mean, you could just make a model with four states, and it's a small system, you say, so it's actually an advantage that it's a small quantum system for modeling it, and just calculate the dynamics and find out how long it takes, right?
Certainly people have tried to model this, and they've tried a number of ways. Again, there often, or there can well be extra assumptions that go into these models, and that things like weak coupling that we might not always really want to make because of this particular system. And also, so I agree, yes, since this is a small quantum system, we avoid the problems of massive scaling that we would have for a problem like Elliott-Capix that we talked about yesterday. But on the other hand, quantum and non-adiabatic effects are quite relevant here, especially since some parts of this process are at intermediate time scales. So let me go back to an earlier slide. For example, suppose that we have completed a photoisomerization process and we just wait for a long time, the system will end up in a thermal state. That's relatively, that is quite simple. And also the photoexcitation up here is relatively simple. But this process is more complicated. This happens over an intermediate time scale. This is a Landau-Zehner transition, which always requires some thought. And what's more, it's a dissipative Landau-Zehner transition. So there's this extra coupling to the bath that makes things complicated. So this seems to require more thoughts. I'm myself not an, my specialty is not photoisomers, but I had this chemist come to me and say, there's this really complicated system that is small, but there are a lot of problems with modeling it. Can we do that more simply to get away from some of these assumptions? And that was basically the motivation for this problem.
Yeah, I think it's really nice to have this bound, certainly, because you get some model-independent statements. But in the end, I mean, the system will equilibrate again, right, on a long time scale.
Exactly, so, that's simple process.
Yes. So as long as you don't know when this actually happens, when the system will be in this trance state, is it really helpful for the experiments in the end?
So we, as I mentioned, we did some comparisons to a, as you suggested, a very simple model where we had Lindblad hopping. And there we did see three regimes. So the very short time regime, the mid-length regime, and the long-term regime. And we checked each of the three laser regimes that I mentioned. We did always find that at some point the bound would saturate. If I recall correctly, it did tend to be in the middle regime, which is what we're interested in because this process is over an intermediate time scale. But yes, particularly when the bound is trivial, that wouldn't be, well, I guess we would be sort of, have to be sort of careful in how we phrase how experimentalists could use this. Suppose that the bound is trivial, so there's an upper bound of 1 on the probability. Then in that case, we would say basically how an experimentalist could use this information is to focus attention on kinetic factors. Like, don't worry about the basic thermodynamics. Turn your attention elsewhere. So that's how it could be potentially useful to people using photoisomers.
Okay, thank you.
So I'll ask a question. In an experiment, how isolated is the system? In some sense, quantum dots can be quite isolated when one studies them in an experiment. And a second question following that. Is your work able to address some open question that your chemistry colleague might have been interested in solving?
Yeah, actually, one reason why I enjoyed this project was he came to me with this question. He said, there is this small, interesting quantum system. We what I really want is bound on the photoisomerization probability, and I really want to understand what coherences are doing or not doing, how we quantify them, and so on. So this resource theory toolkit could finally be used to answer questions that are already out there in another field. Then you asked, how isolated is the system? So the photoisomer itself, as I mentioned, is interacting with some heat bath. So in that system, it is very much open. I can refer to another example. So recall that there were people in Harvard and MIT who attached these to graphene nanotubules. So in that case, the photoisomers were stuck to the graphene nanotubule. And they also found that there were some interactions between the photoisomers. But one way that you could take our results and apply them to experiments would be to take our Hamiltonian and tweak it and tune it in order to incorporate those interactions. Oh, maybe I should add, since you also asked about applications to experimental questions out there, so this team at Harvard and MIT found that the photoisomers improved the switching probability by 200%, even though they had expected an improvement of only 30%. So we have a way of getting the ultimate fundamental limitations on such a bound. So those could be applied to, say, stop engineers from trying to improve the system beyond what it could, in principle, do.
So we'll have one final question right there.
Is it possible to generalize your nice resource theory by generalizing the set of free states? Because in your case, free states are fully controlled by Hamiltonian and the temperature. Suppose you add to the picture number operator and chemical potential. Yes?
Yes. Actually, that is... So this is an application of resource theories to the rest of the world. I've also done work developing the thermodynamic resource theory framework itself, and that's exactly what I did, basically, say, this resource theory models exchanges of heats, but real physical thermodynamic systems can exchange all sorts of things, heats, particles, electric charge, and so on. So I, together with some collaborators, generalized this framework.
So with this, let's close the session. Let's thank Nicole and Yuka as well again.